It's Friday, April 2nd. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, we focus on the plight of online abuse, how it impacts the lives and livelihoods of writers, journalists, and social media users across the board. This week, we have a new report demanding the platforms make some big changes. I talked to our Pen America expert, Victoria Vilk. Then, this week in Tough Questions, our CEO, Suzanne Nossel, lays out why the social media companies have been so slow to act on online abuse. She also highlights the crisis in Myanmar and the wave of anti-trans education legislation working its way through state legislatures. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. For years now, we at Pen America have been raising the alarm about online abuse and the threat it poses to free speech. We know that online hatred, from vicious name-calling to death threats to doxing, has serious impacts on the health and well-being of writers, journalists, and really all users, but it's also putting a stranglehold on free expression. This week, we published a report proposing some major changes we think Facebook, Twitter, and other platforms need to make to shield users from the harshest effects of online abuse. Here to talk us through it, the report's lead author and director of digital safety and free expression programs at Pen America, Victoria Vilk. Hey, Victoria.
Hi, Stephen. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah, glad you're here. So I want to get to the recommendations in just a minute, but I want you to first just sketch out a bit how you got to writing this report.
Sure. So over the past 3 years, I have led Pen America's Online Abuse Defense Program. And my co-authors and I, between the three of us at this report, we've worked with thousands of writers, journalists, artists, and activists who are dealing on a daily basis with death threats, rape threats, hateful slurs, impersonation, and every other abusive tactic under the sun. And honestly, Stephen, we just got really fed up. For too long, the burden of online abuse has fallen on the shoulders of the people who are on the receiving end of it. And those folks are almost always women, people of color, LGBTQ folks, and members of religious and ethnic minorities. And so the goal of the research that ended up, turning into this report was to find solutions. We decided to focus on social media platforms, especially Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, because we know that that's where people are experiencing the most abuse online. And those are also the platforms that people increasingly rely on to do their jobs, to make their voices heard. And we centered our research on the experiences and needs of people who are disproportionately targeted for their identity and their profession, with the idea that if the platforms can better protect their most vulnerable users, they can better serve all of their users. And so the recommendations essentially focus on the design of the platforms themselves from the standpoint of the people who are experiencing abuse. And we really asked ourselves, what challenges are people facing on a daily basis? What kind of tools already exist? Do they work? Don't they work? Where are the gaps? And how can platforms build features that empower people who are on the receiving end of abuse and their allies and deter abusers?
So just getting into some specifics, the report doesn't say Facebook do X, Twitter do Y, Instagram do Z. It is a little bit more principled than that, but you are sketching out some fairly specific, product design changes that you think need to be made. What are some of the highlights?
Sure. So our recommendations kind of fall into three buckets. There are proactive measures, right? How to protect people before abuse even happens. There are reactive measures, how to help people defend themselves when they're under attack. And there are accountability measures, right? How to disincentivize people who are abusing others. So we've got 15 recommendations. I'm not going to talk you through all those now. I'm just going to highlight a few. For example, I'll give you an example. Nobody should have to see every hateful slur and sexist insult that is lobbed their way. What we want platforms to do is to treat online abuse like spam, right? We want them to proactively filter it out so that the people on the receiving end don't have to see it and quarantine it in a kind of toxic holding area, right? Where they can review it and address it if and when they need to. So that's just one idea. Another example, people who are facing extreme or overwhelming abuse on social media, let's say they got a death threat or they are being attacked by a cyber mob because, some right-wing media personality put a target on their back. Those folks, it can be incredibly overwhelming to get hundreds or thousands of messages an hour that are cruel and hurtful and harmful. Those folks need personalized trauma-informed support in real time. And so we want platforms to create an SOS button that people can tap and instantly activate to trigger more protections, to trigger more support. And I'll give you just one more example. Nobody should have to deal with online abuse on their own, right? Right now, if you are under attack and you want to ask a friend or a family member or a colleague or a security person at your office to help you, you have to basically give them the password to your account, which isn't safe. And so what we want platforms to do is we want to be able to assign trusted allies to a rapid response team, right? And then give those allies permission to access certain aspects of their account so that those allies can help them document, block, report, and mute abuse so that they're not dealing with it on their own. Those are just a couple of examples. And if they sound like no-brainers, it's because they are. You know, what we realize is that platforms should have put these measures in place years ago, and they haven't yet.
So you're kind of setting me up here, but why? Why haven't they done this? If it's so obvious, if it's so smack ourselves on the forehead obvious, which it sounds like it is, why is there not an incentive here for them to move?
Well, that is the big question, Stephen. I mean, look, what I found kind of remarkable about this process is that for an industry that's known for its propensity to move fast and break things, social media companies have been painfully slow to addressing online abuse. And I'll give you just one example because it's so shocking. Twitter did not integrate a button to make it easier to report abuse until 7 years after it first launched, right? Which kind of tells you a lot. And the reason is that the business model that underpins social media is basically predicated on maximizing user engagement and attention, right? And that prioritizes virality, emotion, immediacy, but it doesn't prioritize safety. In fact, all of those things actually amplify abuse. And so that's why we've gotten where we are today. But in terms of what we can do to actually get the platforms to make changes, I am actually cautiously optimistic, and there are a couple of reasons. First of all, I think having the reputation of being a toxic cesspool is bad for business. You know, when celebrities like Chrissy Teigen are publicly leaving your platform, when corporations are pulling ad money, when governments are threatening regulation, that's kind of not a good sign, right? It's not good for your business. Second of all, platforms have been loudly proclaiming for years that they are not only committed to creating safer spaces online, but that they want to really prioritize equity and inclusion. And so if that's true, it's time for them to put their money where their mouths are and to invest staff time and resources into building better tools to protect people who are disproportionately impacted by abuse on their platforms. All that said, though, honestly, the only thing that really seems to work is pressure and attention from the public, from civil society, from industry, from legislators. And so I think all of us collectively have to keep up the pressure and make a lot of noise.
Yeah. I mean, just quickly, though, on this idea that the platforms move fast and they're risk-taking, I mean, all these things that I think the platforms love for us to think about them. Another feature has always been this sort of civil libertarian streak that they're a place for free expression and free speech. And that's something that we are concerned about. And I know one of the defenses that the CEOs often raise is, well, we don't want to limit free speech on the platforms. Therefore, all of these proposed solutions about reining in online abuse or even reining in disinformation, I mean, all of this universe of problems that we're all encountering don't hold water. What do you say to that?
That's actually it's a very worthwhile thing to think through. It's a very good question. I think the problem I have with it is that people often position online abuse and free speech as some kind of false dichotomy. And what they fail to see is that online abuse is deliberately deployed to stifle and silence speech. You cannot have free speech. You can't practice free speech when abusive trolls threaten your family and publish your home address online, right? That becomes kind of difficult. So that's kind of the starting point, right? You have to understand that online abuse in and of itself threatens free speech and it threatens press freedom. But that doesn't mean that there are not tensions between protecting free speech and fighting online abuse. And I can give you just one example to give you a sense of what I mean. So, for example, whether or not something can be perceived as harassment can depend on the context. A slur can be used as hate speech, but it can also be reclaimed as a form of empowerment. And we know that content moderation is kind of imperfect. There's a lot of implicit bias. And so if your only solution to the problem of online abuse is just blanket ban content, right, to remove it off the platforms, you might end up further harming the very people that you're trying to protect. And so in this report, we basically took at face value that the tensions and the challenges are real. We tried very hard to think through unintended consequences, how tools and features could be weaponized, where things could go wrong. But too often, people use and platforms use this kind of the complexity of the problem, the very real challenges, as an excuse to throw up their hands and give up. They hide behind the free speech argument. And we're here to say that that's disingenuous, because we have 30 odd pages of recommendations, and we're a free speech organization, right? We have 30 odd pages of recommendations of very concrete things that can actually be done.
Yeah. Well, let me just leave it here. You know, this report goes through a lot of design, product design changes the platform should do. You don't think it should end there, right? Like you think there's a broader set of solutions. Where else should we be looking to try to rein in the effects of online abuse?
Yeah, no, I absolutely don't think this is just about product. I think the problem is so enormous at this point. I mean, Pew basically came out with a study recently that said that almost half of Americans have experienced online abuse and almost 2/3 have witnessed it. So that gives you a sense of how big the problem we're looking at is. So we have to tackle it from all sides. Our report focuses on product changes, but we also basically, you know, platforms have to, if we're talking about platforms, they have to reform their policies. They still have to tighten loopholes in their policies that allow certain kinds of hate and harassment to happen. They have to completely rethink how they tackle content moderation. And there's some very, very good research out of NYU on that. But in order to get platforms to do that kind of stuff at scale, we are going to have to rely on some regulatory reform. It's critically important. It's just that it takes time and it's hard to get right. So we decided to focus on the low-hanging fruit, the stuff that the platforms literally have no excuse not to fix and not to act on. But I might even zoom out a little bit more and say that, you know, it's important to understand that hate and harassment did not emerge with the rise of social media. You know, my co-author, Matt Bailey, likes to call the internet an amplification machine, right? These are things that are happening already in society that are being amplified. And so I think if we're serious about fighting online abuse, everybody's going to have to get involved, right? We need to train people to defend themselves. We also need allies to step in and intervene when they see people under attack online. We need employers to do more to protect and support staff. So I think it's kind of an all of the above, right? Talk about the platforms, but also talk about what each and every one of us can do to tackle this problem.
Well, Victoria, you give us a good place to start. Victoria Vilk is with PEN America. The report is No Excuse for Abuse. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Stephen.
And now it's time for Tough Questions, where we put hard questions about free speech and free expression to PEN America CEO Suzanne Nossel, who joins me now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
So, Suzanne, we just heard our colleague Victoria Vilk talk about the devastating impacts of online abuse and what the social media companies need to do to start addressing it. I want you, though, to zoom out a bit. I mean, why haven't they taken action on this? And what pressure do we need to apply so that they get the message that not only is this devastating for people's lives, but devastating for free speech and free expression?
Yeah, sure. Look, it is, as Victoria spelled out, a very serious and pervasive problem that, you know, it really has censorious repercussions that, you know, hit the hardest those who are most in need of a voice. I think from the perspective of the tech platforms, they tend to talk a good game about the measures that they adopt, the policies that they have in place, their commitment to banishing hatred and vitriol. And yet so much of what constitutes online abuse sort of falls through the cracks of that. It's not manifestly, you know, racist or misogynist. It has to be understood in context. It is a function of the volume and the pervasiveness of particular kinds of communication as opposed to, you know, simply their content. And I think the bottom line is there is a kind of alchemy and synergy between the business models that these online platforms are based upon and the propagation of abusive content. The platforms thrive on intense engagement. And when a swarm of people go after somebody for something controversial or objectionable that they've said, that drives engagement. There's a kind of pylon effect. You know, it's compelling. People are, you know, seem to be losing it. They're, you know, jumping on top of one another's comments at a furious pace. And that is the type of intensive little firestorm that social media really thrives off of. And so I think there is a fundamental contradiction between, you know, the very building blocks of these platforms and their professed but deeply inadequate commitment to combating online abuse. And I think the pressure that has to be applied is one that, you know, ultimately will affect the bottom line. And we know it's very difficult. You know, we saw last summer the effort to force the platforms to become more serious about combating hate speech by getting advertisers to suspend their investments on Facebook for just a month. And, you know, I think it had some effect, but all the advertisers came back. But I think ultimately to push forward a campaign like this requires working on multiple tracks. There has to be a public awareness element of it. You know, in the case of online abuse, it disproportionately affects journalists who are trying to make a living by expressing themselves. So amplifying the concerns and the recommendations through writers and reporters who are talking about these issues. There's a public dimension to it of just registering the level of concern, you know, which is, we know, is widespread about the problem of online abuse. Hitting the advertisers, engaging directly with executives at these companies, informing and engaging the U.S. Congress so that as part of their efforts to apply more scrutiny, you know, this is part of the package and what they're looking at.
Right. Well, I want to move briefly to a very different topic, which is Myanmar. This week, the State Department here in the U.S. ordered most of its personnel to leave the country, which, as we've discussed on this podcast, has been faced with a horrific crisis, both between the military leaders and opposition voices in the streets. We're seeing airstrikes on civilians this week. You know, it seems like, you know, we talked about this last time. You know, the thing that I asked you was what's different this time? And we talked a little bit about sort of the publicness of all of this, how people can see what's going on. It seems like the regime there is not getting the message.
No, it's really not. I mean, and things have escalated in a deadly fashion over the last several weeks, with, you know, now most reports saying over 400 people killed. We had over the weekend a number of children who were just gunned down at these protests in Yangon. So it's a terrifying situation. You now have rebels sort of taking to the forests and arming themselves and planning, you know, military insurrection, you know, ethnic groups that have been engaged in fighting for years, reconstituting themselves, perhaps making common cause to challenge the military government. So it's a frightening and devolving situation. We, of course, continue to work with writers and journalists to make sure that they can carry out their role of documenting and exposing this. You know, that is extremely important. But it does feel like, you know, there's sort of a muted international reaction, and it's, you know, a function of a number of things. Part of it's sort of the change geopolitics with the rise of China and, you know, the secure knowledge that the junta in Myanmar and everybody else has that action, for example, at the UN Security Council would be impossible. You know, China attending this military parade over the weekend, you know, in effect celebrating the perpetrators of the coup. So that's part of it. And then sort of a muted reaction from the West for, you know, a number of reasons, including kind of the discrediting of Aung San Suu Kyi, who, you know, years ago was a human rights heroine, but then, you know, sullied herself by essentially ratifying the grotesque abuses of the Rohingya Muslim minority. So, you know, for us who've worked in Myanmar over the years, trying to build up civil society and enable people who had been repressed for so long to have a voice, you know, these are really devastating setbacks. You know, what is, I'd say the most heartening piece of it is that the people of Myanmar, you know, who for so many years lived under such brutal repression to the point where, you know, even having or expressing an opinion on a matter of public concern was something that people were really afraid to do. You know, they're incredibly brave to take to the streets under these circumstances and to persist with these protests. So, you know, I think where that will is there, there remains hope.
Yeah. Well, just briefly at the end here, I wanted to talk to you about some legislation that's been moving through state houses in the U.S. Just this week, we saw the state of Tennessee consider a bill that would bar schools from using any curricular materials that, quote, normalize or support gay issues or lifestyles. And this is a raft of legislation that we're seeing across the country that seems to really be taking aim at gay, lesbian, trans, bisexual, queer kids. How is this a threat to free expression, in addition to being a threat to the lives of these kids?
Well, you know, it's quite clear. I mean, the idea of legislatures banning certain curriculum or topics from being discussed in schools is just an infringement on the professional discretion of teachers and educators to do their jobs and to address the student populations that they are engaged with. And, you know, unfortunately, this is a new trend that's not limited to just trying to take LGBTQ topics off the agenda, but also 1619 Project, anti-racism initiatives. There's an act that was introduced in Rhode Island that would, quote, prohibit the teaching of divisive concepts and mandate that any contracts or grants include provisions prohibiting the teaching of divisive concepts and prohibit making any individual feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any distress on account of their race or sex. So it's kind of coming from all sides, this sense that, you know, it is the role of government and legislatures to dictate the bounds of what happens in American classrooms, to either include or exclude certain ideas. And, you know, I think that's very dangerous. I think most of these laws would not pass muster under the First Amendment. I don't think there's a compelling government interest in trying to circumscribe our kids' education or substitute the judgment of legislators for those that of educators. And I think, you know, on the contrary, particularly when it comes to these bills that are targeted at identity, it can be incredibly undermining to students who are coming of age and find that their life stories, their perspectives, their experiences are, you know, erased from the classroom and can't be so much as acknowledged. So, you know, for me, this is a real kind of alarm bell, what we're seeing across the country, and something that our program on free speech and education is very much seized with.
Absolutely. Well, Suzanne Nossel is CEO of PEN America. She's also author of Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Take care.
And that's our episode for Friday, April 2nd. Join us next week for the PEN Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at PEN.org. Follow us at PEN America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for PEN America. This is the PEN Pod. See you soon.